Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new containment system put in place over BP's leaking oil well appears to be working. Oil is no longer spewing into the Gulf of Mexico. It's believed that seepage discovered near the site of the disaster is not a sign that the plug is not holding or that the well is compromised. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the latest developments from the Gulf, retired Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen. He's the National Incident Commander for the Deepwater Horizon disaster. I'm sure you have as many questions as I that you'd like to ask. We're going to open the phones early today in order that we can all have this conversation with Admiral Allen. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Commander Allen, it's good to see you again.
Good morning, Diane.
I know you've retired and you're in civilian clothes. Must feel comfortable for you.
Well, I'm comfortable in just about any setting. This is a very challenging job, but I've had to go out and change my attire. My wife's taking me to a men's store.
I understand. Tell us about the cap and exactly how it's holding.
Diane, several weeks ago, I had a conversation with Jane Lubchenco, who's the director of NOAA, and she told me we were going to enter an unusual period in the summer where there wouldn't be a series of tropical depressions being generated off the coast of Africa. In other words, we would have a window. At that point, I went to BP officials, and I said, can we accelerate putting a cap on the well that would allow us to produce at a greater rate and control all the oil? We agreed that we had a weather window, and we did that. That has been now called the capping stack that is currently on the well. They were successful in doing that. We had expected when they put the cap on, we would see a significant pressure build up in there based on the pressure coming up from the oil reservoir. We were thinking it would be somewhere around 7,500 to 8,000 pounds per square inch. That would reflect the difference in the pressure at the bottom is anywhere between 11 and 12,000 pounds per square inch, and the difference would be the weight of the oil in the well. When we put the cap on and sealed everything up, no oil escaped, but we're only to get to the mid 6,000 regarding the pressure. There are two potential reasons why that could happen. Number one, that the depletion of all the oil in the reservoir thus far lowered the pressure naturally, or that the oil was escaping somewhere, we might have a leak. We still do not know the exact condition of the well bore. So as we've gone on day to day with the cap on, and the good thing is there's no oil going into the Gulf, we're looking all around the bottom of the seabed around the well for seepage that might indicate there is a leak until we actually resolve why the pressure was low. It continues to build every day. And it follows the normal curve that a well with integrity would show, but the pressure is just lower than we thought.
What are these little bubbles that we're seeing coming out?
I think we've zeroed out on the word seepage.
Okay.
And they're gas bubbles, and they could be just regular air. They could be, methane gas. One of the things we're looking for is methane gas because that could be an indicator that there are hydrocarbons below that. And, of course, the gas would leak off before the oil would. And so every time we see or detect bubbles or any kind of seepage, we're running that down with seismic and acoustic sensors. And we've had a couple of those anomalies that we've encountered, but nothing to date that would indicate that it's connected to anything that would compromise the well.
Tell me about the letter you sent to BP.
Well, I sent a fairly sterling worded letter on Sunday, basically saying, excuse me, it was Monday, saying that we needed to have some specific details associated with how we're going to move forward because we're in a very complex operating environment right now. We've got a cap on the well. That's good. We need to continue to build out containment because if we have a precipitous drop in pressure, we need to relieve that pressure, and we don't want to vent into the environment any more than we have to. We want to produce that oil to the surface and move it somewhere. At the same time, we need to be looking for seepage and indications that there might be a leak or a problem with well integrity. All of that is happening within about 2 square miles. It requires an extraordinary amount of coordination and what the industry would call simultaneous operations. Because of that, I thought it was necessary to give them some very direct, firm guidance on priorities and what we thought was important.
Such as?
To make ROVs available to follow up on seepage once it was detected, to give them a time limit on when they reported back to us on potential causes and that they had done what they said they were going to do, to give them a performance metric. In this case, to get back to us within 4 hours with data regarding the potential impacts and any data around those the seepages. And those are the types of things that we told them in the letter.
Are they cooperating fully?
They have. They provided us back a plan yesterday. It's being reviewed by our science team. Has been the subject of several meetings and conference calls. As late as 9:30 last night, I was on with Secretary Chu, Secretary Salazar, Carol Browner from the White House, and we were talking about the implications of BP's response to us. And so far, they have been responsive. They have made the sensors available. They have dedicated the remotely operated vehicles, and they're following up very aggressively on the seepage when we detect an anomaly. What we need them to do is build out better containment capabilities in case we have to go to production if something happens with a wellbore.
I don't quite understand the relief wells, what they are and what they're intended to do.
They are the ultimate solution, Diane. What we need to do is actually drill down parallel to the wells, sufficiently low enough where we're now down near the reservoir, and then intersect it. And then the normal industry practice is to fill the entire well full of mud to basically seal it, and then to pump cement in to permanently seal it.
Okay, but explain to me how far down you have to go to do that.
Well, it's very far down. We're probably between 12 and 1,300 feet below the seabed.
1,300?
I'm sorry,
13,000.
Yeah, thanks for correcting me.
Okay, 13,000.
Yes. Between 12 and 13,000 feet, yes.
Below the seabed.
Yes, a couple of miles.
Whoa. And what kind of equipment is required to do that? Does BP have the necessary equipment to carry that out?
They do. Since May, they've actually brought in 2 drilling rigs and been on scene the entire life of this event so far, and have been drilling 2 relief wells in case we have a problem with the first. We wanted a risk mitigator. So they actually have a regular rig that they would use to drill a well, but this is drilling down beside the current well and will intercept it.
And again, what is it going to actually do?
It will drill. There are 2 areas we want to intercept. If I give you a little terminology, there is the wellbore, the actual opening in the surface, the opening in the formation that goes down vertically. Inside that, there is a pipe. Okay, so we have 2 areas we're concerned about. One is the area outside the pipe, but within the wellbore. In drilling terms, that's called the annulus. It's the open area between 2 circles. And then you have the pipe inside. What we are going to do is drill into the annulus. And then we're going to fill that full of mud the entire length of the well to create pressure that will push the hydrocarbons down. And then we are going to put a cement plug in around that opening and kill the annulus, if you will. If the oil is coming up through that area, that could potentially stop the oil at that time. If it doesn't, then they will drill into the pipe and then repeat the same process. It's very similar to having, if you can imagine the concept of hollow tree rings. And you drill into one ring and you fill it, and you wait for that to harden, and the tree just got smaller, and then you drill into the next one.
That is quite a job. How long do you expect that to take?
Well, they should be in position to start the intercept into the annulus probably around the 29th of July. And depending on what they find in terms of oil and pressure, it could take up to 5 days to complete that portion of it. And if they need to go into the pipe, then that would follow. That's the reason I keep saying that this could take us to mid-August to actually kill the well.
Are there government officials, in addition to yourself, who will be standing by to watch how this process goes?
There will be. It's kind of hard to understand how this works. It's almost like a space program. The center of all activity related to what's going on the well floor is actually Houston, Texas, in the BP Command Center. And that's where all the video from the ROVs is remoted back. They have a room there where they monitor everything 24 hours a day. It's called the Hive. and it's full of U.S. scientists, members of the Coast Guard, Department of Interior, and BP engineers that 24 hours a day watch what's going on there. And that's where they control all the operations. The ships out on scene have remotely operated vehicles, but everything is ported back and integrated in Houston.
Now, was this idea of these relief wells developed by BP, by government officials, by Department of Energy? Who decided that that was the way to go?
Well, relief wells are a standard industry practice when you lose pressure on a well. So if, whether it was a well in Texas or at the bottom of the ocean, this is something that they would normally do to try and gain control of a well where they had lost it. In this particular case, BP proposed a plan, had engineering specifications and drawings. Those are reviewed by our science team, which is led by Secretary of Energy, Secretary Chu.
Don't you have to be awfully careful that the seabed itself is stable before you begin with these additional relief wells?
Before any of this took place, including the drilling of the particular well that we have the problem with right now, there was extensive mapping done of the seafloor. And this is what they call time phase 4D mapping, where they use seismic vessels to actually paint what is the equivalent of an MRI of the subsurface of the sea there. So there is a lot that's known about those formations.
That Alan, he's National Incident Commander for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. He's with us for the hour. When we come back, your questions, comments, do join us. And welcome back. Thad Allen is with me. He's National Incident Commander for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. He is retired Coast Guard Admiral. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Here's an email from Pig, who says, please ask Admiral Allen whether it would be possible to pump the well completely dry by having it sent to ship after ship.
Technically, that is possible. That is what we would call right now containment. The problem with doing that is we don't know the condition of the well bore, and what we need to do is just kill the well so it doesn't present a threat. Prior to putting the capping stack on that we have right now, we were actually in a position to produce to floating platforms, and we're offloading that oil, but we weren't capturing all of it. That's what the cap was intended to do.
How much oil was captured?
We were capturing about 25,000 barrels a day before the capping stack went on, and that was through a combination of a drilling rig called the Q4000 and a production vessel called the Discoverer Enterprise.
And so the result of putting the capping stack on meant what?
It would meant that we could then produce to four platforms because we'd have additional manifolds coming off of the capping stack. What happened was we had an opportunity to actually close all the valves to see if the well had integrity and basically shut it in. That's when we found out we had the lower pressure. So where we're at right now, the well is capped. and no oil is going into the environment. But we need to continue to build out the capability to bring that oil to the surface, because if we find a drop in pressure or we believe there's a problem with the integrity of the well, then we immediately need to shift to production and bring that oil up so the pressure doesn't threaten the well.
How much are you involved in overseeing the cleanup?
Well, I'm designated as a National Incident Commander, and as that, I have what's called Federal On-Scene Coordinator Authority. This is authority under law to actually direct removal actions for BP. And in fact, when I give BP directions and I sign them a letter saying I need these plans or this type of a detailed specification on what you're going to do, that actually has the authority of law, and it carries criminal or civil penalties if they don't adhere to it.
How good a job is the cleanup that's underway?
Well, I think it's going pretty good right now. I think there were some hiccups at the beginning. I think we didn't anticipate the number of volunteer vessels we were going to have and how to organize them. I think as the spill spread geographically, it started testing the number of resources in terms of boom and skimmers that were available. I think our logistics chains are in good shape now, and we've organized the vessels of opportunity into task force. We've given them communications equipment and tracking devices so we know where they're at. And I think we're pretty much hitting our stride on the oil spill response. And we need to realize just a lot of oil out there on the water, even though the well is capped.
What happened with the A-Whale, that huge ship that we thought was going to be able to pull in thousands of gallons per day?
Well, I believe when I was on last time, I got the question about the large tankers that were used in the Arabian Gulf. And I said at the time, and I think it still holds true, these tankers have to have a lot of oil in one place and be able to bring it in and then separate it from water to be effective. These vessels are very large. They're operating around an area where we have a lot of vessels that are already working. And the oil where they finally encountered it was pretty much dispersed and not all in one place where it would be economically feasible to use that ship. It did its job, but I think the type of oil and the operating environment there was not the type of oil or operating environment where they could be as effective as they could be with that platform.
So are you saying that the tankers that are out there are smaller and thereby more effective in pulling in, separating out the oil from the water?
Correct. The skimming equipment we use right on scene right now are not tankers. They're, what we do is a common way would be to have a boom pulled between two boats in a U-shape behind them. The oil is collected and then vacuumed out. You're almost better off. We have about 48 skimming vessels out there this morning all around that well site, skimming oil out there. And the smaller ones that can actually concentrate the oil and pick it up or evacuate it are the ones that are being effective right now.
All right. We'll open the phones first to St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Good morning, everybody. My concern is about the stability of the pipe inside the borehole, and I seem to remember at some point, maybe by Richard Harris, there are some rings, sort of spider-like rings that surround the pipe and go out to the cylinder walls of the borehole, and the drilling company had suggested to BP that they have 20-some of those stabilizers along the way for various geologies going through hard and soft and so forth, and that BP used only 6. Could you comment on that, please?
I can comment on what they do. I'm not sure I can comment on the design and the construction of the well. I believe you're talking about what we would call pressure burst plates. And these are plates that go around the pipe casing in the well bore. And what they're intended to do, if you start to reach a pressure in the well that would compromise the integrity of the well, the piping, or the well bore itself, these plates would actually burst and relieve the pressure. And there's a question of what condition are the burst plates in? Are they intact? And this gets back to the questions that we don't know about the structure of the well bore. But you're correct. That's what those are intended to do.
Hope that answers it, Jim.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to Sykesville, Maryland. Good morning, Janelle. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
First of all, Admiral Allen, I think you're doing a terrific job. I don't have much faith in BP, but when I listen to you, I totally believe your sincerity, and I believe you really know what you're doing. But I did have a question. Apparently, BP had posted an altered photograph on their website showing that they had cut and pasted three underwater images onto a wall video, showing video feeds. I wondered what your opinion on that was, because, it undercuts their credibility to me. And if they're faking photographs on their website, then what else are they faking and not telling us the truth about? And my other question is, you did answer it about the supertankers and their use, but what are they doing with all the oil that they are managing to suck up? What's happening to that oil? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question. I'm not familiar with the photo in question, but I will check it out, and I'll pass a note back to Diane on what we found out about that, if that's okay. Regarding regarding the oil that is being collected, that is being taken to various facilities around the Gulf and being offloaded. BP has made a commitment to take all the profits and the proceeds from the sale of the oil that has been recovered and put it in a fund for wildlife recovery.
So none of that money will go into BP's coffers.
That's correct.
How's that sound, Janelle?
Thank you very much. I was just going to say that the article about it is in today's Washington Post on page A6 regarding the altered photograph, if you wanted to look at that page. So thank you.
All right. Get a hold of that, Janelle. Thank you. To Strongville, Ohio. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. My question for Commander Allen is the oil rig itself. My understanding is that there was an explosion, that it caught fire and sank, but I haven't heard anything about the recovery of the rig. Did it sink to the ocean floor? Was it ever in the way of any kind of salvage or recovery efforts? Do you know what happened?
Yes. The Deepwater Horizon right now is upside down on the ocean floor. About 2,000 feet from the well itself. It was connected via a riser pipe to the wellhead, so you can imagine about 5,000 feet of riser pipe jammed into that short. If you remember seeing the kink pipe and the way it was bent and everything, that was a result of the pipe being bent when the rig turned upside down and sunk. It is at the bottom of the ocean. I don't think there are any plans right now to try and salvage that or recover it. It is at a mile deep, and it may just become what probably fitting that it should be a monument to the 11 people that lost their life out there.
Are there any further indications as to how the explosion occurred in the first place?
Well, what's happening right now is we've convened what we call a Marine Board of Investigation, and that's under the joint authority of the Department of Interior and Homeland Security. It's being led by a Coast Guard captain. They have subpoena authority, and they're actually meeting in New Orleans this week, and they will produce a report. It will be, in some ways, not dissimilar to what you would see the National Transportation Safety Board produce after an aviation accident or something like that. But in this case, we're doing it jointly with Interior and Homeland Security, with Coast Guard, and what was Minerals Management Service and their successor organization conducting that together.
How soon do you think we'll have that report?
I'm not the commandant of the Coast Guard anymore, but I would say in about a six-month time frame to complete all the work.
6 months.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts about how that explosion occurred?
I do not, and that's really hasn't been the focus of my work. Obviously, they lost well pressure, and when they lost well pressure, there was a large amount of natural gas came up first. There's every reason to believe the natural gas may have exacerbated the problems on the ship regarding the explosion and the fires. But I think we're really not going to know until they finish the current Marine Board of Investigation. And frankly, when we finally get the well sealed, we'll be able to bring that blowout preventer to the surface and do some forensics on it. That probably is the closest thing to a black box that we have in this event.
Is there any indication that the explosion was deliberately set?
Oh, I don't have any indication of that. I don't think that's been indicated by any of the information we have thus far, although that would be the purview of the Marine Board of Investigation.
All right. To Hot Springs, Arkansas. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning, Diane. Hi. Good morning, Admiral, or retired Admiral. My question concerns the toxic chemical dispersant correct set, and is it being used actually to mask the high levels of methane and combining with that methane to produce something even more toxic? And also, is the aerial spraying of Corexit over populated areas still taking place, and if so, why?
Those are all great questions. I don't think there's been any more controversial issue that I've discussed in this response, separate from the response itself, than the dispersants. And just to let you know how the senior leaders in this town work, Lisa Jackson, who is head of the EPA, she and I talk almost daily. And a lot of our talk is about the use of dispersants, where we got to in this response and where we need to go in the future. First of all, dispersants are less toxic than the oil, but we have never used dispersants on the scale that we've used them in this response. And just to alleviate the fears, we do not use dispersants over land or near populated areas. They're only used under strict protocols offshore when the certain conditions are being met that allow them to be used safely. That said, even something that's less toxic than oil but still has some toxicity associated with it, when you end up putting over 1 million gallons into the water, you have to question, what is going on. I don't think it was ever anticipated when dispersants were approved after the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, following the Exxon Valdez, that they would ever be used on the order of magnitude that they're being used right now. So we actually have a plan between the Federal On-Scene Coordinator and EPA to significantly reduce the amount of dispersants that are being used. There are sometimes legitimate reasons. They reduce volatile organic compounds on the surface that can present problems for worker safety. But in general, we're going to be focusing on mechanical skimming and in-situ burning and limit dispersants to only where we actually have to use them.
I want to read to you an email, Admiral Allen, that comes from Boyd, who says, I understand from earlier NPR reports there are questions about the integrity of the well casing, i.e. BP used only 6 reinforcing bands, where industry practice called for as many as 20 per given length of pipe. Is that correct?
Well, again, my part is the response, so I wouldn't want to comment on the
okay.
engineering. But it gets back to my previous statement. I think they believe they're talking about burst plates that provide a release for pressure if it's building up to in the well bore or the casing. But other than that, I wouldn't want to comment on the engineering of the well itself because I'm coordinating the response, and that's not my area of expertise.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. There's one other sentence here. He says, if they want to stop the flow of oil from the well, why can't BP just stick a pipe down the inside of the existing well casing and pump in concrete from the bottom?
Well, that's exactly what we're going to do. Pumping concrete in from the bottom is the way we're going to kill the well. We tried to pump in mud and then concrete from the top in what we called the top kill exercise a number of weeks ago, but we pumped mud in. We were able to suppress the oil, but when we stopped pumping the mud in, the oil came back up. In other words, we could not generate enough pressure from the top to be able to do that. And so the other way you do that is to intersect the well with a relief well from the bottom and do just that, fill the entire well bore with mud and then cement. What we are considering and BP is proposing is that maybe with the cap on right now and the ability to hold pressure, we might want to replicate the effort we made before and actually put mud in from the top. And our science team is reviewing that right now.
All right, to Ryan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning to you.
Yes, thank you very much. I have a few quick questions, and then I'd like to take my response off the air.
Sure.
If the blowout preventer at the onset of this incident had worked, wouldn't it have caused this seepage and possibly some unstable collapse of the seafloor at that point in time? I'd like to know if there's any information about how this is affecting Mexico, Cuba, any other Gulf nations, and what is the volume of the well, and how long will we stay and watch once this event seems to be taken care of?
No, those are great, great questions. If the blowout preventer had worked at the time of the event, we would have expected then that the pressure inside the blowout preventer would have been the same differential that we were looking at with the capping stack. In other words, it should have been 7,500 to 8,000 PSI, which would have accounted for the difference of the oil in the well above the reservoir, which is at 11,000 to 12,000 PSI. Now, how that would have ultimately impacted the well integrity, we'll never know because that didn't happen. But that is exactly what we're trying not to do right now with the cap on it and looking for seepage and any indication that we might be losing well integrity or having leakage that's irreversible. So we'll never know because the blowout preventer was not activated. But we were expecting the same amount of pressure that it would have experienced when we shut the well in, and we haven't achieved that. And that gets us back to the discussion, do we have a depleted oil reservoir down there, or is it leaking?
And he also asked about the effects on Cuba and Mexico.
Right. There are longstanding international protocols developed through the International Maritime Organization and the UN that require consultation with foreign countries that might be impacted by an oil spill. And early on, we actually reached out through the State Department, and we actually have had discussions and done briefings with Cuba. We've also talked to the Bahamas and Bermuda, and we have a briefing scheduled for Mexico. It is our duty to keep our foreign partners advised of any potential impact on their shoreline, and also we would need to coordinate any response efforts under international treaty.
Has Cuba or Mexico expressed concerns?
I think they were more in the information gathering mode. They wanted to know the condition of the well and any implications on the trajectories.
Retired Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen, National Incident Commander for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. We'll take a short break. I hope you'll be with us when we return.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Smokey Robinson has been called America's Poet Laureate of Love. The Motown legend, on his 50 years in the music industry, the addiction that nearly ended his career, and co-writing thousands of songs. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We now have in front of us the article from the Washington Post by Stephen Mufson, who talks about an altered BP photo that has come into question. What do you make of this, Admiral?
Well, apparently by BP statement, they had some blank screens where normally they would be running ROV screen images or running video feed, and they just filled them up with some photographs. I would suggest they probably need to take a little more care in how they do that in the future.
I should say. Okay, let's go now to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Diane. I hope my concern isn't too picky. But for weeks now, I've been hearing Admiral Allen say things like, we're going to pump mud into the well, we're going to drill down, we're going to cap this thing. And these are activities that I don't think the Coast Guard has the capability of. And when the constant use of the pronoun we, it sounds like Admiral Allen is making the Coast Guard a partner of BP, which is not what I expect, certainly.
Thank you, and let's have a little semantical conversation. I think it's probably in order. First of all, in my current duties, I'm the National Incident Commander, and I'm also a Federal On-Scene Coordinator. I'm no longer in the Coast Guard. I'm assigned to Secretary Napolitano's staff in the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm in the National Incident Commander, and that means a whole-of-government approach to this thing. And I've always stressed from the outset that one of my main jobs is to create unity of effort across the federal government, but vertically, with state and local governments and with industry. One of the challenging things about this response is that the means of controlling the source lie largely in the private sector, and there's not a lot of government capability to solve the problem. And you can have a conversation moving forward about public and private sector allocation of resources and get to macroeconomic theory about who should own this, but the fact of the matter is, in this response, industry largely owns the means to fix the problem. So when I talk about we, it is an inclusive we regarding the national effort that spans government and the private sector and the need to have unity of effort to solve the problem.
But it's clearly not the Coast Guard who's in there trying to clean this up.
That's correct. The main means of a response lie in the private sector, and it's not clearly with BP either. There are a lot of other companies, including the seismic survey companies that are there, the people that operate the ROVs. This is really a collection of private sector capabilities that have been brought together under BP as a responsible party because they are responsible to pay for it. But it is a we in terms of a whole of government, whole of industry, whole of nation.
Does that answer it, Robert?
Yeah, I think so. But as I say, I thought that Admiral Allen and the Coast Guard were really there in a very strong effort to supervise and control what's going on, not be doing it.
Well, let me just add another comment here. The fact of the matter is that the responsibility of the Federal On-Scene Coordinator is to ensure that the responsible party does their job.
Exactly.
And I've been very directive with BP. If you read the letters that I've sent out in the last several weeks, they're not ambiguous. They're very direct. They require certain responses and a certain standard of performance that I think the American public should expect of BP.
And you are satisfied with the responses you've received.
And when we're not, we ask for a clarification and we ask for more detail, and they are providing it. Yes.
They claim they've spent billions of dollars already on this cleanup. How much more do you think it's going to cost?
Oh, I'm not sure I even want to hazard a guess on that, Diane, because there are a couple of things sitting out there that we haven't even begun yet. One of them is something called a natural resource damage assessment that's required under the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 to assess the impact on the environment and long-term issues regarding how do we go back fixing this or restoring it. And I think that is the next conversation that will need to be had after we finish the response. But I don't think we're anywhere near the end of this.
Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Hi there, John. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. My question for Commander Allen, and just as an initial comment, I want to say I'm proud of your communication skills and your technical skills. I think you've done an excellent job of what you've been tasked with down there in the Gulf. My issue concerns the initial reporting of how much oil was leaking out, and I'm going to use a phrase called intentional incompetence on the part of BP, because it went from 1,000 barrels per day to 60,000 plus, according to which estimates you read. And if they knew what they were doing, they must have known in the beginning that we were talking about a major, major event. And their deliberate, I believe, misrepresentation of that led to your job being much, much harder, the initial response being much less robust than it should have been. And I'd like to hear your comments on that. I'll take comments off the air. Thank you, Diane.
Thanks, sir.
No, I get that question a lot, and it's a good question. First of all, when I was first called and advised that there was a fire and an explosion, we in the Coast Guard and we in Homeland Security and the government immediately knew that we had a potential environmental crisis of significant proportions on our hand, if for no other reason than there were 700,000 gallons of diesel fuel on the Deepwater Horizon just to operate the vessel itself. So had nothing else happened, we were dealing with nearly 1 million gallons of diesel oil that would have to be dealt with. For that reason, we started mobilizing salvage personnel and response equipment very early on. We were never constrained in the early days of the response by any flow estimates, whether they were 1,000 or 5,000. In fact, I stated several times publicly that while we didn't know what was going on and they were trying to develop these estimates, that was not the basis for which we were moving equipment in. I will tell you this, though, the entire extent of this response ultimately went far beyond the response equipment that would have been required under the plans that BP had, and we've gone well beyond that because of the geographical spread of this oil and what we've had to defend, as far as how much coastline we've had to defend. What I did a couple of months ago was actually set up a separate government group called the Flow Rate Technical Group. Ultimately, that is under the supervision now of Marsha McNutt, who's head of the U.S. Geological Survey, and we actually use our own independent government estimates, and that's how we got to the current estimate of 35,000 to 60,000 barrels a day. That was not informed by any input by BP other than them providing us unblemished video feeds that we can analyze for looking at the velocity and the volume of the flow.
Thanks for calling, John. Here's an email from Kevin, who says, please ask to the Admiral who had or has the authority for the cleanup from day one.
From day one, the federal on-scene coordinator was the local Coast Guard commander, and BP, by law, was the responsible party. The relationship is, and this is under the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 that was passed in the wake of the Exxon Valdez, is the responsible party pays. And they're required to bring contracted personnel and do whatever they need to do to clean it up. It is the responsibility of the federal on-scene coordinator, which is usually the Coast Guard commander, to enforce that and oversee, and they actually have what we call removal authority. We can direct them to do certain things for the response, and if they don't do that, they're subject to criminal and civil penalties.
He goes on to say, particularly, did the Jones Act prevent use of foreign vessels in the cleanup?
Yeah, that's another question we get. There's a law that goes back, I believe it's to the 1920s or 1930s, that says if you're going to be involved in coastal trade in the United States, that those vessels have to be built in the United States. And of course, this was a law designed to protect U.S. shipping companies and keep them in the trade. If we need to bring a foreign flagged ship in and they're going to go within 3 miles and constructively engage in what we would call coastwise trade, they would require a Jones Act waiver. The foreign vessels we are using are operating outside 3 miles, so that has not been an issue.
I
don't think it's well understood, but the Jones Act has not been an impediment to this response.
Additionally, he goes on to say, Senator Mitch McConnell recently said the government did not order any skimmers to the area until 70 days after the spill. Is that true? And if so, why?
No, it's not true. The response plan submitted by BP to the Minerals Management Service as a condition of operation identified skimming capability that would have to be brought to the scene. I think what the senator may be referring to is we at one point realized that with the new flow rates, we would have to be dealing with more oil on the water than was anticipated, and we launched a major, major operation to bring more skimmers into the area.
All right, and to Norman, Oklahoma. Henry, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Deanne.
Morning.
Listen, I've got a couple of comments. The first is that what I'd like the Admiral to do is allow us, as petroleum engineers with a lot of experience, to look at some of this data that BP has collected, that pressure buildup data. It's imperative that we have what I consider the very technical, competent people look at this. There may be 20 or 30 around the country and around the world. I don't think BP or the government has all of these guys or the experience. I myself have done this for 40 years, and I think that if BP, at the request of the Admiral, could publish two columns of data, the time under pressure since this test begun, within 24 hours, guys like myself and others can tell him what's the condition in that wellbore.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. In fact, I've even seen those curves myself. I don't think there's any secret about them, and nobody's trying to not make them public. In fact, they're in briefing slides we've used. I can tell you this without having the information in front of me right now. The curve of the pressure, and if you're an engineer, you'll understand. I'm not, but I've talked to a lot of them lately. There's a rapid increase in pressure, then it levels off, then it slowly increases after that. And the line of time versus pressure for this shut-in generally follows a well that has integrity, but the initial pressure and the pressure it reached was lower than we had anticipated, and that brings us to the question of, was there depletion in the reservoir or is there leakage? And I'd be glad to take a follow-on if there's one.
Yes, there's one. The curve itself doesn't tell you a whole lot. You have to look at what's going on inside the well bore itself, things like storage and skin factors, which a typical guy would look at a curve and say, there's none. But you have a guy with the experience and the intellectual capacity to do this, he will come up with a different answer. And based on the historical trend I've seen with BP in the last 92 days, I believe there is something missing in this analysis. And guys on the outside and people can look at this and maybe have a different interpretation.
Well, I think you're exactly right, and I think even the scientists we have down there from the government and other private sector companies may not always agree. In fact, that's the reason we're still doing the test and looking for seepage, because there's not general agreement about what the source of the low pressure is and what the curves mean. I would tell you this, that as part of the science team that's headed by Dr. Stephen Chu, the head of the Secretary of the Department of Energy, and Secretary Salazar, and Marsha McNutt from U.S. Geological Survey, and Tom Hunter from Sandia National Labs, we've got a lot of pretty good sure. Brain power on this. Plus, they have consulted with folks like Chevron, Shell, and ExxonMobil, and other petroleum engineers. We have not just dealt with BP on this. We've aggressively sought third-party validation. But I have no problem releasing
publishing the data.
Yeah, technical data.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for calling, Henry. You've raised good questions. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Columbus, Ohio. Hi there, Will.
Hi. My question has to do with the moratorium. What is the main motivation for the moratorium? And if it's for more federal oversight, what steps are being taken to increase oversight, and what new inspection methods are being implemented?
Well, on the first half of your question, I'd have to demur to Secretary Salazar and the President and his staff. There's been a lot of discussion about the safety of the deep sea drilling wells and wanting to understand more about what happened here and the implications for other drilling. That's in the policy area, as I've been telling everybody all throughout. That's a little above my pay grade. I will demur on that part. Diane, did you get the second part?
What was the second part, Will?
It was about the oversight. Federal inspection methods are being implemented, new methods.
Yeah, that's a good question. What I'll do is I'll go back and tell you what I said when I testified before the Senate when I was still a commandant. They asked me if and there's a commission that's going to be stood up and looking at this, and we have a Marine Board of Investigation. I basically said there are three things we probably need to look at coming out of this. One of them is how we review response plans for deep water rigs. That traditionally have been within the purview of the Minerals Management Service. I think that needs to be a joint effort by the Department of Interior and the Coast Guard that will be actually mounting the response as we did this time. So I think a joint review of response plans is in order, number one. I think number two, the Coast Guard had issued a certificate of compliance to the Deepwater Horizon, which was registered in the Marshall Islands. A certificate of compliance indicates that they have a certificate that it was issued by their flag state that they are in compliance with international standards, safety standards, and we basically certify that they have that certificate. I think there's every reason to believe that we may want to do what we do with foreign flag cruise ships. And that's actually do a safety inspection. It's a little broader than that to make sure they're in compliance with international standards. And finally, I think sooner or later we're going to have to take a look at third-party inspection and validation
exactly.
of drilling systems.
Admiral Allen, how has this crisis affected you personally and your life? Do you have a life anymore?
Well, after the 25th of May, when I was relieved as Commandant of the Coast Guard, the best thing about that is it allowed me to focus full time on this job. Before that, there were some distractions. In fact, I put the Vice Commandant of the Coast Guard, Vice Admiral Dave Pekoski, I made him acting Commandant. so that I would have the fewest distractions in trying to address this as a National Incident Commander. Since that time, I've been able to focus all my time and effort on it. It is a large, complex problem, probably the largest that I've dealt with in my career. But at the same time, I think everybody would agree that it's noble work needs to be done, and there needs to be a sense of unity of effort being brought to this response, and a tremendous opportunity to try and impact that, and it's a great opportunity for me and a personal challenge.
What about your personal life?
Well, there'll be time for that. I think we need to get this well capped, and my wife and I are looking at some point taking a trip to Ireland.
To Ireland,
that
yes. Sounds good. Admiral Allen, on behalf of everybody in this country, thank you so much for the work you've done and for being here, being willing to speak so articulately about the work.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Coast Guard Admiral, retired Thad Allen, and we'll hope to have him back again before long to answer all your questions. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.